Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
I was like, this is not what I want to spend my life doing. And then that's when, you know, this offer from Al Jazeera came, where they were like, well, we want somebody to lead the innovation studio here. Would you do it? And I was, I guess, out of my frustration, I was like, no, I don't want to do this anyways. So I'm going to like put forth a list of demands and see if they'll actually agree with it. And I told him, I was like, I want to hire my own team. I want to have complete control over editorial. You know, I want to be able to, like have a training program that's part of it. I want to choose the location where I work out of. And they agreed. They agreed to all of it. And so that was sort of, that became the genesis of Contrast, wherein our goal was, yes, to create these immersive experiences, but it was, I think the DNA of the project is, how do we make sure the people who don't have access to the technologies, but whose stories are being told all the time, learn how to use these tech and are able to tell stories using it.
How you dare? That was the voice of Zahra Rasool, and we were talking about collaborative journalism, how to make sure we have a more inclusive media. And I really love Zara's perspective, because not only is she a TCK, a third culture kid, she really comes at it from a perspective of how this is a definite way to change the world, how this is something that informs our policies, informs the way we grow, and informs the lifestyle we choose to, you know, cultivate and create. And in our podcast interview, you can hear how her personal background and the habits she formed when she was young really informed her habits today. So I really hope that as you listen to the podcast, you have this sense of purpose to understand that anytime representation is mentioned, diversity is mentioned, inclusion is mentioned, it isn't just a buzzword. You know, it is essential to making sure we have the world that we deserve today. Hope you love the podcast. Hope you check it out. I'm going to be putting a lot of her information. She runs this amazing studio as part of Al Jazeera's media platform, and you should check it out. I think they're doing pretty interesting things, and it's an interesting way of telling stories. So make sure you check it out. Make sure you give her a shout out, and make sure you write us a review. All your reviews matter. So leave us a 5-star review and let us know what you think of the podcast. All right. Enjoy the episode. Welcome, everybody, to another episode of As Told by Nomads. And today's guest is Zahra Rasool. She's the head of Contrast, which is part of Al Jazeera Digital. Now, what she focuses on is pretty interesting to me, and we're going to dive into that in the interview. But she focuses on the research and production of compelling 360-degree videos, and she goes into different types of immersive storytelling. And I'm so interested in hearing how she does this authentically across cultures. Welcome to the show, Zahra.
Thank you, Matteo.
The pleasure is mine. So, before we get into who you are and how you came to be this amazing storyteller, I want to give the audience a little glimpse of your TCK identity. And I know we talked about this earlier when we had a pre-production call. But you know, tell us about your background. Where did you grow up, and how did you become so passionate about journalism and storytelling?
So I actually grew up in Mumbai in India, and growing up, you know, we had a rule in our house that we had to read the newspaper every morning, my brother and I, regardless whether we wanted it or not. And every night at the dinner table, we had to discuss the news, what we read, well, how we felt about it, and then we watched the news together on TV. And I think at a really young age, you know, there was this recognition that the people that I was seeing on TV, the cultures that were being shown and the people that were being spoken about in the news were very close to the cultures I belonged to, because I grew up at the time of the Iraq invasion, the war in Afghanistan, and so much of the news that was told was about people who were living in cultures that were similar to mine, that shared my religion, people who looked like me. But, you know, what they were talking about them didn't feel like it was, I didn't feel like my reality at all. You know, I grew up in a family with an incredibly strong mother, really strong women all around, and, you know, never had this, the narrative on TV at that time, and even now, actually, it's no different, is that Muslim women are oppressed. If you cover your head, it's because you're doing it by compulsion. All of these very stereotypical views of what Islam is, what a lot of the Eastern cultures are. And so, you know, that was how, that was what I saw growing up. And so I remember, you know, telling my parents that, well, this is not our life. This is so different from our life. And, you know, I felt very misrepresented. And so my dad told me, he was like, well, things won't change unless you actually become a part of the media and you work towards that change. And so I guess, like, from a young age, there was that interest in going into journalism and being part of the media.
Yeah, it's interesting because I heard that story of the newspapers and your parents when I was watching one of your talks, and it really reminded me of my background as well, because of that's exactly what my dad would do, and I've talked about that often, where he would read the newspaper front and back, and then he would turn on the news. It would be BBC, CNN, and then the local news station. And I used to ask my dad, you know, why he did these things, and then he would say to me, well, I can tell you, the world is bigger than you. And if you want to succeed in it, you have to understand it. And he would always tell me, you know, sort of similar things. And that was in Nigeria, and I was in Burkina Faso as well. But it's fascinating to me how that simple habit of understanding the idea of getting different perspectives on one narrative or one group of people can really influence people. And I suppose it plays a big role into why you're so passionate about this, because the stories that we do hear about Muslims, for example, isn't always told from an accurate point of view. And it's not usually told by people who live in the culture.
Absolutely, and especially not Muslim women. Mm. Mm. You know, think about, like, all of the news stories you read about Muslim women, almost all of them are fixated on the headscarf, as if that's the only dimension of Muslim women that is there to explore. You know, and so is the media representation, whether you see in music, movies, televisions, if there is any, is all that.
Right, right. And yeah, I'm because I think we're close in age, but I remember I was in an American international school in Burkina Faso, which is a country in West Africa, when 9/11 happened. And I remember a lot of the narrative. Nigeria is a country with nearly basically 50-50 Muslim Christian, you know, slightly more Muslims than Christian. So, you know, as a Christian, I always grew up with a lot of Muslims around me. I even have some of my family where we just coexisted. So it was always interesting for us to see the narratives, because we were like, wait, mom, dad, is this that was a question that I was asking myself. And I was like, but why is this such a, you know, why are we painting like such a horrible picture or broad strokes with that? But I remember the Islamophobia that was really spiked up in that. And I've listened to other comedians, even like Asam Minhaj, who was Muslim as well, Muslim, Indian. He talks about how that shifted, you know, perspective from that. So how can we then do a better job of making sure that the subjects of our stories are the center of the story?
Yeah. And, you know, the interesting thing is, right, like this oversimplification of people, and especially people of color, I think is a problem predominantly in the West. Mm-hmm. You know, there are issues that exist, you know, we have, like, there's racism in the East and, you know, wherever you travel. But, like, you see the representation of, of women, for example. I find that so much more nuanced and more powerful in, like, in India, or when you travel around the African continent, you know, you see women and the way their abilities and their strengths are explored and their personalities are, they do a much better job of that in our country.
Yeah. And I have a theory on that. I've always said this theory. So I think a lot of a lot of this comes from an ethnocentric point of view. I think because of the way things have been shifted, you know, a lot of the culture seems to be like Hollywood is here, music, the center is here. So a lot of people that live in the West feel like people come to us, so there's no need to understand the other element. But on the other side, there's a pride in understanding where you're from and who you are, in addition to knowing the other side. So you have those multiple perspectives when you come here, because first of all, you really need to know who you are, and you need to understand how you navigate different tribes or different ethnic groups. But then if you want to coexist, you also have to have sort of a cultural know-how of Western lingo. And I think that added layer sort of plays a role into that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. And but the reason why I then would always push back on my colleagues here when I first came here, because they did limit me to single stories. I've shared a story of people singing Lion King stories to me before, or singing Lion King songs to me rather, because I was from Nigeria. Is I always wonder how to, I always talk about the importance of doing the same thing that Eastern cultures do, because that's how humanization and empathy starts. But I'm curious to hear your point of view on how we can develop empathy and, I guess, more authentic storytelling.
Yeah, you know, the interesting thing is that when you think about stories, right, like especially in the West, you know, and I can talk only to the American context, very okay. little European, because I work here. I travel and, you know, do a lot of speaking engagements in Europe, but most of my work is primarily, I'm based here, I live here. In New York. And so I think that, you know, even when we think about empathy, who are we wanting to empathize, right? Like, it is the white person. So we find, like, you know, even for somebody like me who wasn't born in this country, moved here when I was around 18, my default is speaking to the white person, because that's how all our narratives are shaped.
Right.
And so a lot of the, and so, you know, I have to keep that in check, you know, because we need to be able to tell stories that are for us also. Because to me, the most powerful thing about storytelling is to be able to reclaim your narrative and to be able to use it as a tool for healing. And we can't do that if the subject for all of our stories or the people who we are creating these stories are for white people.
Yeah.
And so that's something that I you know, explore a lot in the work that we do. And just to, you know, a little background about what I currently work on. So my job is to look at new and emerging tech and to use that for more innovative storytelling and journalism. 360 video is a very small part of what we do, but we look at the tech like VR, AR, volumetric capture, artificial intelligence, all of these things. And then we try to use them to craft stories. And so that's what me and my team does. That's our focus right now. And it's interesting, isn't? Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead. I had a follow-up question, but I know you wanted to finish your thought.
Yeah, and it's interesting because in this space, like this niche of like technology and storytelling, I think the storytelling is even more problematic because your technologists have now become the storytellers.
Wow. Wow. Can you elaborate on that more?
Yeah, so, you know, because it's harder to, it's more difficult to understand how these technologies work. The people who understand the tech of it end up being the ones who are in charge of the narratives. And we all know who are the people that are that's no secret. And so those are the stories that are being told constantly. They're even more exploitative. They're even more one-dimensional. They are lacking depth. And, you know, they are created specifically for, they're created for a very specific elite audience.
Yeah, so I love what you're saying, because you're saying, you know, stories are universal. They're basically the oldest form of communication that we've had from time. But the things that have changed are the means through which stories are transmitted, whether it's video, audio, now VR, immersive technology, and all these things. But the gatekeepers, the ones that do a lot of the creation, that create a lot of the platforms, that own a lot of these platforms, they do generally look like one group of people. And as a result of that, bias seeps in, and that plays into the type of stories that you tell. And that coupled with the fact that, to your point, a lot of the default things, the default beauty standards tend to lean towards Eurocentric views. The default standard for just how we view politics, how we view religion, how we view beauty, the same sort of thing. And so that is going to continue to influence the next generation if we don't diversify the ecosystem.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, completely. And I my background is in traditional journalism. It's in investigative journalism. I have 2 degrees in journalism, which I would not recommend to anybody.
But, you can't just say that. Why would you recommend it? Because I'm very curious to hear that.
Because, like, you know, it's funny because I grew up with Indian parents and, like, they didn't pass down any, like, math or science genes to us because they were artists. And so we were, like, pretty unique in that case where we, like, weren't doing what other kids were doing around us, which I thought at that time was probably good. But then I was like, oh, I want to study journalism. Like, my parents didn't tell me not to do that. I could have, like, gotten a degree with more useful skills. But yeah, I started in like investigative journalism, right? And I then gave that up to do my own startup, which was at that time like digital platforms were emerging, and you know my startup focused on using different digital platforms to actually tell stories that are curated from around the world by people who live in those parts of the world. It's called Gistry, like gist of the story. And I did that for a couple of years. And then, you know, while I was doing that, there was a company in LA that saw the work that I was doing and asked me to come on board to be their managing editor. And they were working with VR, and it was a space that was like completely unknown to me. And I thought it was interesting because I didn't know anything about it. And so I joined and kind of learned on the job. But I was so frustrated being in the industry. I worked for 2 years in that space, and I was like, this is worse than the journalism world, just because like it's so much more niche and the skill level is higher in this. And so the people that you work with are not diverse at all. And the stories that are told are not diverse. And I was ready to leave. I was like, this is not what I want to spend my life doing. And then that's when, you know, this offer from Al Jazeera came where they were like, well, we want somebody to lead the innovation studio here. Would you do it? And I was, I guess, out of my frustration, I was like, no, I don't want to do this anyways. So I'm going to like put forth a list of demands and see if they'll actually agree with it. And I told them, I was like, I want to hire my own team. I want to have complete control over editorial. You know, I want to be able to, like have a training program that's part of it. I want to choose the location where I work out of. And they agreed. They agreed to all of it. And so that was sort of, that became the genesis of Contrast, wherein our goal was, yes, to create these immersive experiences, but it was, I think the DNA of the project is how do we make sure that people who don't have access to the technologies, but whose stories are being told all the time, learn how to use these tech and are able to tell stories using it.
Wow, that's impressive. I love that you demanded that. And then one of the things, probably the most important thing that you demanded was you determining who made up your editorial team. So then my follow-up question to that is, what exactly is your editorial strategy?
Yeah, so my, you know, our editorial strategy was that it was to cover issues in the developing world of people of color and to tell those stories by collaborating with them. And the stories had to fall within the most pressing issues of our times that young people are currently facing. So it's pretty broad, but you know, we are our audience is, the Al Jazeera audience is so wide. I mean, it's international, so we have a lot of, you know, different topics that we can focus on.
Yeah.
But it was that, it was like collaborating with people from the communities to tell their stories authentically.
So collaborative storytelling mixed with investigative journalism, essentially.
I won't say we do investigative journalism, but we'll do journalism. We don't spend months like investigating an
issue,
unearthing something that you don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess the reason why I even brought those two things up is because I spent a lot of time in media and talking to media and also being, interviewing journalists. And sometimes I do hear that people feel like it's incompatible to be investigative and collaborative. I don't believe that's true, but I hear that a lot, especially in newsrooms. When I just get, sometimes I'm just sitting in a newsroom and I see what they're saying, like, oh, we're competing with clickbait headlines, or we don't have enough time, or there's no way to spend to find the right source, and the media industry, the journalism industry has moved past that, so sourcing takes too much time. And I was always curious about that, because then I always say, then that, you know, you're not telling the right story. But then the right story doesn't sell, is what I hear.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I firmly believe that there is no alternative for collaboration and co-creation. Mm. In journalism, in storytelling, in entertainment, in anything, if you want to be able to represent people right, if you want to get the truth, if you care about authenticity and representation, this is what you need to do. I mean, every documentary that we've worked on, you know, we've had producers who are at the same level as my producers, who are working on the docs. We don't have a hard time finding these people. You know, we are living, you know, we're living in a digital age where it's really easy to find contacts anywhere in the world. It takes effort, but it's not impossible. I think a lot of the times people don't do it because, you know, it requires them to spend some time reaching out to people, stepping outside the comfort zone. And it's just easy to just hire your friend who you've worked with before.
Boom. There we go. And that's the exact point. I think that's the point of a lot of the things you talk about, that journalism, storytelling, and, you know, what you do with your platform, whether it's with documentaries or videos, is you need to put the effort to know the people you tell the story about. Otherwise, you do promote disinformation, and you actually do something that's more harmful, you know, when you choose comfort over competence. Satsui.
So, and we've been hearing this for a while now. There's a lack of trust in the media by young people. Younger generations don't trust them as much. And there are multiple factors for that, right? But like one of the main factors is that the younger generations have intersectional identities. They relate to different identities, and we are not doing a good job of actually representing them at all. Yeah. People of color don't trust mainstream news organizations because they feel like they're constantly being betrayed by the way they're portrayed. They are not being listened to or heard or being having a conversation with. And this is not a new problem. This is a problem that has existed since the start. But yeah. You know what's frustrating is that we're in 2019 and we're still facing that issue.
Yeah. Yeah. And I also think, you know, this is someone that loves media here, but I also think that there is, if we look at the news today, I don't know what type of CNN you used to watch in India, but the type of CNN I used to watch in Nigeria, it seems very different than the CNN I see now, because a lot of times what I see is like this, you know, you have like this four squares and it's the loudest person. And it's like all these panels and people just debating something that I feel like is not actually covering the news, and the loudest voice usually wins. And then there's a clip of that goes viral, and that becomes the news. And it's not even just CNN. I'm just using CNN as an example. It's on all sides. And then it becomes just talking head thin. You don't actually get subject matter experts to educate people on the stories. And I don't know if it's a shift to try and get clicks and more profit, but that also plays a role, I believe, in distrust, because when you start to see a pattern and you know what's the most viral video, oh, that person got taken down by such and such, that takes away from the whole point of what news is, or even the type of stories that you like to cover. This is just my opinion, but I could be wrong.
No, absolutely, absolutely. To be honest, like, I don't watch cable news TVs unless I'm working out in the gym and there are like the big screens in front and they're playing there.
But that's the thing. You're even proving the point that's the thing. We've now become so desensitized to something that should be important to inform us. And, you know, and it's now like, you know, this is just another one of those things. I really want to hold platforms more responsible to that. So I'm glad that you're doing that. Talk to me about the storytelling that you give me examples of storytellers that you've stories rather that you've covered. Because I know that you've gone around the world to host screenings and you've told several types of stories, but I want to get into what exactly you showcase and highlight.
Sure. So like I was saying, our editorial mandate is the kind of stories that we cover editorially are issues that are relevant to young people in developing countries and in communities of color around the world. And so I'll give you an example of a documentary we did, and then speak about something that we're currently working on.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
It was a story about an oil spill in Port Harcourt in Niger, in the Niger Delta in Nigeria.
Oh, Zara, you know, what are you doing to me?
Exactly. That's why I took that example.
Okay. Go ahead.
And so our co-producer, so we went to Port Harcourt to film the piece, but our entire strategy, and this is sort of how we model the collaboration and the co-creation part of it, right? Is our co-producer on the piece is a Nigerian-American writer, and then our music composer is also Nigerian. We worked with, you know, of course, an all Nigerian crew on the ground to tell the story. The story is told from the perspective of a girl called Lessie, who is working in her community, who was displaced because of the oil spill, and so she takes us back to her village to show us how her village was destroyed because of the oil spill. And we do that using live action footage on one side of the screen on 180 degrees, and on the other 180 degrees we recreate through animations what you remember her village being.
Wow.
So in a 360 space you have like one of what it currently looks like, what the ground looks like, what the soil looks like, what the water looks like, and then on the other 180 you see through animations what it used to look like based on her memories. And so, you know, that's the story that we followed. And then, as I was mentioning, the co-producer is Nigerian. The person who did the musical score is Nigerian. We worked with a lot of other Nigerian talent to tell the story. After the documentary was done and screened at festivals, we partnered with Samsung and with a local Nigerian creative agency called a White Space Creative Agency in Lagos to actually do a pop-up so that people could actually watch it in the headset. So it was not just us creating the documentary and then submitting festivals, but we wanted for people there to be able to experience it as it is meant to be experienced in a headset. So that is one example of a documentary we do, and almost all of our original productions follow this format. Something that we're currently working on right now, we're working on an installation piece around incarceration, gentrification, and using themes of Afrofuturism, and it's an interactive VR piece that tells the story of incarceration. It's an audio and augmented reality piece that tells the story of gentrification. And both of these experiences live in an installation that's designed by artists, imagining what Harlem, because the story is based in Harlem, would look like had the people there not faced the injustices that they did. So those are kind of the projects they're working on. With the Harlem piece, like from the get-go, you know, my goal was I wanted all the creative people on the piece to be people from New York City who identified as Black, because there is a huge disparity between people who are able to work in these fields because of lack of access to the technology and skill level. And it's usually people of color and you know, at the lowest rung of the ladder are Black people. And so it's really hard to find that talent at that level. And I, you know, one of the things that you won't have the talent unless you don't invest in them, unless you don't educate them, unless you don't give them opportunities. And so one of the, you know, goals of this project is that how do we make sure that we are also, while creating these experiences authentically, make sure that people who don't get the opportunities are given the opportunities to do the creative work.
Okay, so I have so many questions. Okay. First thing that is pretty selfish, I'll get it out of the way. You mentioned my my hometown, Lagos. What was it like for you to visit?
I love Lagos. It's one of my favorite cities in the world.
Yeah, man, you hear that, everybody? You hear that? Okay, it's all good. All right, now back to
I mean, the art scene in that city. Oh man, it's nothing like I've ever seen anywhere else.
Exactly. That's what I try to tell these people. I try to tell them all the time. But check out Lagos. I'm not getting paid, but just go to Lagos for your next vacation. I promise you. See, Zara approves of it. I know you will too. But you brought up a few terms there that I understand, but I'm sure the audience might have some questions. So you said augmented reality, immersive technology, and the 360. Can you explain what they are and how much depth they add to your documentary storytelling? Because I think that that's impressive, but I just want the audience to be able to feel why that added layer, or those added layers rather, really bring the story to a heightened level.
Sure. So these are all different tools. These are like the technologies to me are tools for us to use to tell stories mm-hmm. in different ways. So with virtual reality, with the interactive VR piece, for example, when you put on the headset, you know, the story is shot primarily in a brownstone in Harlem. And so when you put on the headset, you can actually, you will, like, we've used something called volumetric capture, which means that you take thousands of photographs of a place and then you put them together in a way that that entire space is recreated in the headset. So you'd actually feel like you're in that location. And you can also move around and you can touch things and you can interact with them. So that's what volumetric capture allows you to do. And then with the interactive VR parts, when you're putting you put on the headset, you actually feel like you're inside that brownstone. You can walk around in that brownstone. You can, the way the story is designed currently is that you can touch different objects, and then the objects will actually trigger video stories that wow. will that are part of the narrative of the piece. Wow. Yeah, I mean, if you need me to simplify that even more, let me know, because I'm so used to talking about it, sometimes I forget that. Just don't understand.
No, that's what I was asking the question. So for the listeners, you can basically feel a lot of the things that are going on throughout the story. So if you see something or something said in the story, you can hear what that sounds like and feel what that sounds like. And that's what technology
does. You can't
does.
Feel as in like, you can't feel like touch.
Yeah, not
that, you can do it. Like, I mean, and you can, that's possible. We've not done that in this piece, but like, you know, you can hold something, you can pick something up.
Yeah.
Things
yeah.
like that. That's the interactivity part of it. You can open a door, you know.
Wow. Well, have you seen, have you gotten feedback from people that have participated in observing this, and have they told you what that was like for them?
So actually, we just finished filming the interactive VR piece, so it's still with the developers in post. Yeah. We're hoping it will be done. You know, these things take a long time to develop.
I can imagine. Yeah. Okay. No, I was just curious about that because I know sometimes I always hear VR, AR, but sometimes I was like, well, I don't know if everybody knows what those things are. I just know that that's the term, but it's thank you for explaining that for us here. And especially with the camera work, I can imagine that there's an intentionality with the angles and all that.
Yeah. And also with AR, just to define AR a little bit, is, you know, when you have, with AR, you can augment your reality. That's basically what it is. So, you know, if you have a surface, you can have something appear on the surface. If you have a building and you want to show what it looked like, you know, 30 years back, you can sort of add those layers using animations or illustrations or CGI to overlay on that. And you can have augmented reality. You can view it through a headset that would reveal itself in the form of a hologram, or it can be through your phone, which is a window to, like, you know, seeing something on it.
Yeah, that's so cool. For those listening, before I ask my next question, how can they work with your team, or what's the process for pitching stories to you, or is there a process at all?
Yeah, I mean, there definitely is one. On our website, we have our contact page, and people can just write to us in the partner with us section.
Okay. I'll put that in the show notes. Now, the last question I had here before I dive into things on the personal end is more about the fact that what I heard was intentionality. You told me about the Nigerian story with Port Harcourt, the oil spill, and then, you know, the Lagos and the use of the Nigerian artists for score, for, you know, for several aspects of the production. And that strikes me as something that is simple, but not easily implemented in many newsrooms today. And so I love that you've created a platform and you've shown that you have to be intentional about the storytelling. But how do we get that to a mainstream level?
You know, I think it really just depends on personal, on, you know, editors, people working on their projects. I think we got to do the work to reach out to people. You know, for example, on the Nigerian documentary, like, you know, there are tons of people in my roster of musicians who I could use to the score. But why would I, when there are so many talented Nigerian composers that I could find? And it wasn't really that hard to find people. You know how talented the people are there.
So I do.
I mean, it's just about reaching out to them and, you know, spending some time to get them to understand your workflow and have some patience in educating them the way you need the work to be done.
Exactly. I didn't mean to interrupt, but that's the point that I've always had people argue with me on. It's like, why should I spend this much time educating someone in my process when I could already do
that? I'll tell you why. Because the product, the end product, is so much better than you can imagine. You know, it not just looks right, it feels right, it sounds right. You know, there are just so many more layers of depth into that are added to your story when you do that. Also, the other thing is that, you know, when we're doing this, when we do stories like that, we start building a community that we wouldn't have otherwise. So then the people that we work with will tell other people in their community, you should check out their work. You know, they actually cared about what we said and, you know, wanted to collaborate with us. Like, suddenly they start trusting us. We would not have been able to build that trust had we actually not done that.
Exactly. Yeah. Boom. There you go. And I'm so glad you said that, because that's always what, you know, I always have conversations with, and I say the same thing you say, that you, especially because I do a lot of diversity and inclusion in companies, and that's my number one role. It's when we talk about pipeline strategies or how to find people of color or people in marginalized communities, it's always like, it's going to spend too much time to just educate and invest in all this. And I'm always saying, you've got to think about the long term and the community aspect of this, because if you can't replicate the environment that you live around, you're just going to create this further divide, and it's going to ultimately hurt you in the long run. But it's still, you're just actually, there's a responsibility that you're dropping the ball on. And
you know what I hear very often is that, oh, it's so hard for us to attract people of color to work with us.
Yep. I hear that too.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And I was like, yeah, you do, because you only want them as a representation. You don't actually want their voice, which is something that I see happen all the time around me. It just happened to me a lot of the times. You know, people look at me and they're like, oh, she checks so many boxes, well, let's bring her on. But they don't actually care about what my perspective is, you know, the way I look at the world, about my experiences. Those are not integral to them, important to them.
Yeah.
And so you treat people, when you treat especially people of color like that, women of color like that, people don't trust you anymore and they don't want to work with you. So if you're having a hard time recruiting or attracting people of color, then you got to really look deep into your practices.
100% and well said. And you brought it up many times. The stories that are being told about Muslim women, for example, are almost virtually always false. The stories being told about people in developing countries are always very, very false. You and I come from countries that have been lambasted in the media and told through singular narratives and you know, almost you know, caricatures of our culture. And India is so diverse in religion and ethnic groups and just economics. Same thing with Nigeria, that it is actually a crime that you can't really arrest people for. I'm just going to say crime. Yeah. It's a crime to actually just limit people to singular stories. It's irresponsible.
Yeah. And also, you know, the other thing that I truly do believe in is that, you know, in order to make space for other voices, sometimes we got to give up our own voice.
Yeah.
If you want to make place at the table, you want somebody else to have power, that means you've got to share your power.
Yes.
You can't have it your way all the time. And that's the same thing with the storytelling that I say, right? Like, there might be a story that I'm really, really interested in doing, but I can see that there's somebody else who has a much more powerful voice than mine, who has much more knowledge and information and depth than I do about that subject. So then my goal becomes to step aside and support that person to be able to tell that story.
Yeah.
Because that person's going to do a much better job than I'm going to do with regards to that.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't always have to be the director and the producer. Sometimes I can just help somebody be that.
Yeah. And it always pays off in the end, because sometimes, unfortunately, I do see a lot of the crabs in the barrel in their mentality, where if I'm here, I'm just, there's no other option. And so, to your point of sharing, that power needs to be given. But in addition to that, what I'll add is there needs to be a bigger picture thinking. I think sometimes when we approach narratives or storytelling or even diversity and inclusion, we think about it through a very short-sighted view. And I'm like, you've got to look at the long-term effects of what this is going to be. And that, in addition to sharing power, will lead to just what we're talking about here.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
All right. We're getting ready to wrap up here, but I wanted to close with some of the personal questions about your identity. I know you talked about earlier, people trying to poach you for their companies because of you checking all the boxes, but how do you, Zara, define yourself? You know, you're someone that has grown up now in multiple cultures. So what would you say your identity is?
Man, that's a hard question. You know, if you'd ask me where's home, I will automatically say India, because that is home. That's where I was born and raised. But that doesn't always feel the case when I'm there. I think in my mind it is more so than it is in the
reality. Yeah. Yeah.
So, I have so many places around the world. And so my identity truly is, I guess, I mean, of course, I identify as a brown Muslim woman of color, grew up in India. But whether am I American, am I Indian, am I something else? I don't have an answer to that.
Yeah.
Where I guess, you know, where I find people who I can share similar values with, who feel similarly about the work that we're doing. It's actually just like finding the community, wherever you find a community that you fit in, that sort of becomes home then.
No, I'm glad you said that. And that's really why I brought this up, because I wanted to highlight to everyone listening, people that are potentially dealing with the same thing, is that many times we've lived in a world that tries to label us before we even label ourselves. And sometimes we're much more than one thing, right? You know, you said brown Muslim woman of color, who's also someone that identifies with sometimes not feeling Indian enough, or sometimes not feeling American enough, but also in America and in New York, where there's diversity and inclusion. And there are other aspects of your identity that you probably are yet to even discover. But when we do commit to authentic storytelling, which is what you do, you leave the door open for full expression of self.
Yeah, absolutely. I said that really well.
I was picking up what you were giving me. This is off you.
One of the things that I feel like is one of the biggest challenges is, like, people always want to put you in a box, and I was like, but it's like I literally fit in no box.
Yeah, exactly. What if you don't fit? And then when you don't fit in the box, you then create your own box, and it's okay to have your own box. But we don't have you're fixing that now, and I'm encouraging others to do, me included, and everyone, to continue to tell more different types of stories, so that we can sort of create the spaces for everybody to have their own boxes, and for us to understand that, you know, the world isn't just told through one lens. And I firmly believe that that's part of the reason why we are this divisive time now, whether it's with the politics or with media or any of these things. I think it's no coincidence that a lot of what we've laid the foundation on with stories play a role into how we see people, which play a role into how policies are formed, and then it becomes all these, you know, weaponized forms of divisions.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. All right. Where's Zara's favorite place in the world to travel to?
My favorite place that I've been to recently was Ethiopia.
Ethiopia, okay, East Africa. Why? What about Ethiopia?
I mean, it's just, you have to go there, man. It's magical.
Okay.
People are amazing. The food's so good. I really like spicy food, and, you know, they have some incredible food there. It was interesting to me, like, you know, I had heard about Ethiopia in the context that it was the only country that hadn't been colonized, and I didn't know what that felt like to be in a place like that, because I've lived in a country that comes from a very heavy colonial past. And most of the places, you know, in the developing world I've traveled to have had some of that. And it was really different. The experience was different. And I really enjoyed that.
All right. Shout out to Ethiopia. What about best favorite food for you?
Favorite food?
Yeah.
I have to stand up for Indian food.
Indian food. Okay.
I don't cook at all. So it's not like I eat it very often. But when I do, I really enjoy it.
Okay, well then we're gonna stay with India here. What is the difference between Mumbai and New Delhi?
I haven't ever lived in Delhi, but being from Mumbai, I've only visited. But being from Mumbai, I mean, I just have to say that Mumbai is a much, much better city.
Okay.
People are much cooler. It's more fun. I think the food's better. I know a lot of people would disagree with that, but we're like the fashion capital and the entertainment capital of India.
Oh, so Mumbai is actually the entertainment capital.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, oh. It is. Oh. So the only thing Delhi has is politics, which nobody has ever wanted. So.
Okay, look at you. Okay, well, there you go. If you want to go to India, make sure you first of all check out Mumbai. And then you go to Lagos, then you come back to New Delhi.
You know, the funny thing is, like, I went to Lagos, it was like so similar to Mumbai. And I was like, man, this feels like home. I could totally live here.
I say this all the time to my Indian friends. I feel like there's such a kinship with our cultures just because I think India has even more. We have over 250 ethnic groups and several different religions. And I think India, you know, like Lagos to me sounds like Mumbai. It's like a loose version of New York, and then all these type of things. And I'm like, there, all the chaos, the traffic, the different languages spoken, just the horrible driving.
Yeah.
but
people thought I was like, you know, I was Nigerian. I was like maybe like biracial, but like they were convinced I was half African. You know.
Yeah. Yeah, they'll call you half caste there. They'll say you're half caste. Yeah.
I also wear the head wrap, and I wear the head wrap, in a different way. So they like it felt so welcoming too. It was like, you know, the assumption was that you belong, rather than when you travel in Europe or even here, the assumption is that you are an outsider.
Right.
You don't, unless like you've proved yourself that you belong.
This is amazing. I mean, I you know, when I asked Zara to come on the podcast, I didn't realize that this would be a PSA for Nigeria. But now that you know that Nigeria is an amazing place to go to, I'm very grateful to you, Zara. So thank you for that.
Of course, no problem. Thanks for having Kayo on your show. This conversation.
The pleasure is mine. But before we go, the last question I always ask my guest is this. It's my mission statement. My mission statement is use your difference to make a difference. So how do you, Zara, use your difference to make a difference?
You know, I'm unapologetically different, and I'm not afraid to show that, even when I'm, you know, in professional settings, because I think a lot of people feel the constant pressure to fit inside a box or to conform to certain standards, and especially women. And, you know, I think I did that a lot in my career too. And now I've just stopped doing that. It was like, you got to take me as who I am as a whole person with my values and my ideals. Because unless you don't do that, people don't realize there are people like that who exist.
Huh. Well, I mean, that's amazing. So everyone, please check out Contrast. Contrast is an amazing platform. I'll make sure I put that in the show notes. And if you want to partner up with them, they have a partner with us section that would also be in the essential notes of the podcast. But as a reminder, Contrast is, you know, it's part of their immersive Al Jazeera's immersive storytelling studio, and they explore underreported diverse stories from and about marginalized communities and developing countries. Thank you so much for coming on the show, Zara.
Thanks a lot, Tayo.
All right. Pleasure is mine. Till next time, ladies and gentlemen, use your difference to make a difference.
You've just been listening to the As Told by Nomads podcast. For more ways to reach out to Tayo and to use your difference to make a difference, head over to www.tayoroxon.com.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.